You are listening to episode 85 of the Tennis Files podcast with special guest Bill Kellogg.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the Tennis Files podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files podcast. I'm really pleased that you could join me today for another fantastic episode. I'm actually going to be leaving in a few minutes to play a 9-5 combo match with my buddy Victor. So that's a 5-0-4-5 pairing. So I'm really excited to do that. But I figured, hey, let's get this intro and outro done before I head off to play some competitive tennis, which is always fun to do, always great to try to come up with winning strategies and tough matches and just live in the moment. So it's really a fun time and I'm really looking forward to playing tonight. But today's interview for this particular episode is with Bill Kellogg. He has had a very interesting and fantastic career so far, and he's definitely not done yet, of course, but being the president of La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club, which has been designated top 25 resort by a very reputable site, I think Tennis Resorts Online. And on top of that, he's done a lot of really cool things in his career, such as being a linesman at Wimbledon and playing pro tournaments and serving with and for the USTA and being very heavily involved in Davis Cup and Fed Cup and senior national tournaments. So really cool conversation. I really enjoyed learning from the very wise and sage Bill Kellogg today. So I really do hope you enjoy this episode. And without further ado, here is my interview with Bill Kellogg. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files podcast. I'm really, really excited to have Bill Kellogg on the show today to talk about how he has hosted some of the biggest tennis events in tennis, and also about his many incredible experiences in the tennis world. We're going to get into both his playing career and also his many different positions that he's had in the tennis world, and I'm especially grateful to Bill because he's really contributed a lot to the tennis industry, and as we'll get into and as you'll hear. Just a little bit about Bill's background, actually more than a little bit. Bill is the president of La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club, which has been designated a top 25 tennis resort by Tennis Resorts Online. Bill was also inducted into the Southern California Tennis Association Hall of Fame in 2017, alongside such legends as Rod Laver, Bobby Riggs, Debbie Graham, Ken Stewart, and Stella Sampras Webster, which is an incredible class there. Bill has also competed in pro-level tournaments, and he played number one for Dartmouth College, and he participated in the NCAA championships while playing for Dartmouth. Bill also serves as a sectional delegate of the Southern California Tennis Association and was also a longtime member of the International Advisory Council of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and he was also previously a director at large for the USTA with the audit committee specifically. Besides that, Bill has also previously served as a linesman and chair umpire at Wimbledon, which is incredible, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later on. And Bill is also responsible for overseeing several other properties under the Kellogg umbrella as well. And big shout out to Charlie Warner for connecting me with Bill. So Bill, I really appreciate you joining the podcast and I'm very excited to speak with you today.
Well, great to be here, Mehrban, and love to tell you a little bit about what my life has been like. So.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's incredible how long La Jolla has been in existence, and just kudos to you and your family for that. But to start off the round of questions, Bill, I'm sure you get this question all the time, and I'm sure you'll probably facepalm or something when I ask you this, but I have to ask you, what relation, if any, do you have to my favorite cereal brand, Kellogg's?
Well, I love it. And I eat it all the time, but I'm actually related to the cereal branch of the family before cereal, BC. So my particular family branch actually was involved in the newspaper business.
Interesting.
So my great-grandfather was a publisher of the Detroit Daily News and had a bunch of newspapers in the Kansas City area for many years. He was credited with inventing classified advertising.
Wow.
And you know, as a way to make a newspaper profitable. Then he came out to California, worked a little bit with William Randolph Hearst, bought up a bunch of community newspapers, and ultimately, you know, he retired from the business, and that's when he started the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club.
Wow. Wow. Very interesting stuff, Bill. That's cool to know. And what, Bill, was your very first memory of actually hitting a tennis ball, and when was that?
Well, I can remember hitting against the net when the net was probably about 10 inches taller than me. So I was pretty young. My dad used to have the babysitting duty on Sundays. And so what he would do is he would take me and my brothers and sister down to my grandfather's court, where he had a weekly foursome. And I had a couple of choices. I could sit and watch him play tennis, or I could go hit balls against the garage door. And so I would do that. And then every once in a while, he would let me sneak in and hit with a couple of the guys in the foursome that he had going, you know, in between sets. I thought that was pretty cool. And it sort of hooked me on playing tennis. And really not being able to play tennis is what probably made me want to play tennis.
Interesting stuff. And Bill, I mean, you know, some kids, when they would tag along with their dad, you know, maybe half of them would not be interested in playing. So what in particular about tennis was it that attracted you to the sport?
Well, I think some kids are fascinated by balls and sports and some are not. And I just happened to get that gene. So, you know, it was fun for me to watch how all the guys had a great time on the court. And I would, you know, see how one person would, work out a way to win a point. And it was just fun for me to watch. I just was very intrigued by the whole thing. I developed a little bit of skill at it at an early age. So it was fun to do. I didn't have to pick up the ball all the time. I also had this vision of being able to knock a hole in our garage door someday. And I kept working. There was a loose board there and I was sure I could do it. I never did, but anyway,
wow.
It was a great inspirer.
Very cool. Very cool, Bill. And before we get into a bit about your very interesting career in tennis, I just want to ask you this fun question that some guests, you know, have more trouble with than others, but I'm sure you'll get through it, Bill. But what are three things that most of the world doesn't know about Bill Kellogg?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've got, I think one of them you alluded to earlier is that I was a linesman and a chair umpire at Wimbledon in my early days. My major sport in high school was soccer. I was actually captain of my high school soccer team and not captain of my tennis team. And then the other major part of the school curriculum where I went, to a place called Thatcher School, and it was built around a horse program. So I've got a very strong background in horseback riding, packing horses into the Sespe National Forest, and that type of thing. My mother actually ran a stable, so I've got some different sorts of backgrounds, and you know, I was brought up doing all sorts of things, skiing. I had to play. I got to play Little League baseball and had to make a decision between tennis and baseball, you know, in my early teens. Those are a couple of things that maybe a lot of people don't know about me.
Wow, wonderful stuff. I really like how athletic you are, Bill. So many different sports. And I got to ask you, too, because you said that you played soccer seriously and obviously tennis. And then we'll get into how you played pro soon after that. So how did the soccer and tennis coexist together? You know, did one help the other, and were they different seasons, and how did that all work out?
First of all, in high school is really where I got into playing soccer a lot, and I was lucky because the soccer season was in the fall and the tennis season for the guys was in the spring, so I could easily do both sports. And you know, I think that soccer is a great translation to tennis from a footwork side of it. When you have to figure out how far you are away from a ball and end up kicking it with the correct foot, and you know, the footwork that you use to defend in soccer, very, very similar to what you do on a tennis court. So I thought it was really something that helped. one thing that was very surprising to me is I played center half in soccer and ended up, you know, being able to run the whole game. I played the whole game and run up and down the field back and forth. And I didn't play any tennis while during the soccer season. So, you know, I'd get back on the tennis court. And it was amazing to me how I would be completely out of breath and out of shape for tennis, in spite of the fact that I could run for miles on the soccer field. When I got to college, I had visions of playing on the tennis team and the soccer team, but that got squashed quickly because I ended up finding out that the soccer and the tennis season were both at the same time. I had to be on either training for one or the other. I couldn't do both because they were simultaneous. So I ended up choosing tennis over soccer. But anyway, that was that was sort of the end of my soccer career. But I really think it had a lot to do with building strong legs and just a general overall athletic ability that's translated very well to tennis.
Wow, that is very cool. And also very interesting, too, though, that you, as you mentioned, after the soccer season, when you'd go and play tennis, you'd still be out of breath. And I guess, you know, that's something to be said about specificity in your training. And I guess, you know, tennis has different intervals and things like that.
Yeah, you don't really realize it, but tennis is a bunch of short, sharp bursts, basically a lot of sprints. And when you get into long distance running, like on a soccer field, it's really more of generating a rhythm, and it's not a start and stop so much. I mean, there certainly is some of that, but it's just really surprised me how different they are in terms of just being able to be fit for that particular sport.
Yeah, definitely, Bill. And, you know, you would think at first, I guess, at first thought, at least for me, because, you know, I would think of soccer as you're sometimes going at a slow pace and then you'll sprint occasionally. But I guess it's still kind of different with the recovery and all that.
Right. It's just the frequency of how often you sprint, because tennis is, every point is pretty important.
Yeah, super important. So great stuff again, Bill. So as far as your tennis playing career, how did you end up deciding to play pro tournaments after high school?
Well, I ended up getting to take a summer trip to Europe. And that was an interesting experience, because I mentioned the fact that I got to umpire at Wimbledon. My initial stop in Europe was to go to London for the championships. And I, you know, sort of walked up to the door unannounced, and I asked if they could use somebody to help with the tournament. And you know, the guard sort of looked at me strangely. And I said, are you kidding? And he said, well, I'm a tennis player from Southern California. Could I at least look at center court? You know, and he was very nice and opened the door and allowed me and the guy I was traveling with, who's my doubles partner, to go in and see the center court stadium. And while we're walking around there, somebody from the office had found out we were there and came running up and said, you know, hey, would you like to? He said, we could use another couple of people because they were short. And I said, you know, can you report for duty? And I think it was like in 3 days. You know, do you have a blazer? And yeah, I do. And he said, okay, here's a rule book, handed me the rule book. And I showed up and started umpiring matches. So, as a linesman to begin with. But one of the things that happened while I was there is that right in front of the window that sent all the matches out to the courts, the control window, a lot of tournament promoters would hang out around that window. And when they discovered that I was from California and I was a tennis player and so forth, they started offering me opportunities to play in tournaments in Europe after Wimbledon was over. So the first one that I got to play in was the Irish Open in Dublin. And then they had another one on the West Coast. I'd written ahead to a couple of tournaments, so I had a couple of commitments to play. And so I ended up getting to play in Dublin, Ireland. I played a tournament in the country in France, and then I went to Switzerland, played at the Palace Hotel, and I played in Gstaad and Bastad, and traveled to Italy. And it was an incredible fun summer, and you know, got to play with and against some amazing people. So it was really a dream, and something that I really enjoyed doing.
Wow, that is really incredible, Bill. And so after that experience, I mean, what was your mindset? Did you think, or did you at least consider doing it again or turning pro or anything like that? Or like, what was your thought process in deciding your next steps after that experience?
You know, it's funny how you make great plans and God laughs and sends you in a different direction. You know, when I went to college, I actually had visions of being an engineer. And so, you know, after my summer tour there, I went back to college and my major was engineering science. And, you know, I really thought that that's what I would end up doing rather than being a professional tennis player. Although I enjoyed it and I loved it. And I really, you know, would have liked the opportunity, but I just felt like, you know, I should do some real work. So anyway, I ended up graduating from Dartmouth College in the summer of 1973. And I worked a little bit at a tennis ranch up in Big Bear, California, for Dick Leach. He and Bill France, a couple of important tennis people in the Southern California world, were just starting to build. You know, they had their camp and they were starting to build tennis clubs. And at the end of the summer, right before I was enrolled to go back to graduate school in engineering, my doubles partner, the same guy that I went to Europe with, his name is Kevin Clark. I think it was about August 31st, and you know, the school year was supposed to start on about September 12th. And I went down to play tennis with him in Lacey Park in San Marino. And he asked me if I would, he told me that his dad had just built a tennis club. And he was going to give up his job there at working for Dick Leach and asked me if I had ever thought about teaching tennis. You know, I'd been going to school for a lot of years, and at that moment in time, you know, I'd talked to my dad about it a little bit, and he actually had said to me, you know, it's not such a bad idea to take a year off and get refreshed. So when Kevin told me about this job, it sounded pretty interesting. I said, okay. I said, you know, I'll give that some thought. What do I do? And he says, well, show up tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in the morning and you can teach the lesson I was supposed to teach tomorrow because I got to go out and work for my dad. And so I did. I showed up at 8 o'clock the next morning and taught my first tennis lesson. And then I started working for Dick Leach, and he actually taught me how to handle lessons and clinics and the business of the pro shop and how to string rackets and, you know, how to really develop my skills as a tennis player. And so I ended up getting to play some terrific tennis with Dick and with the people that he typically hung out with. So I got into that business. And then a year later, he opened a tennis club out in Westlake Village. And he asked me, I was actually interviewing for a job with an engineering firm at the time, but he asked me, you know, would you be interested in going out and running this club for me? Because he had his own business, and he and his partner each had an assistant pro. So I was his, and there was another guy named Richard Tripp, and the two of us were sent out to Westlake Village to open up the Westlake Tennis and Swim Club in Westlake Village. And we got in there on the ground level. They were just building the clubhouse at that time. We had to develop the programs for marketing the club memberships. We had to figure out the accounting systems for the club. We had to understand pool chemistry because we had a big giant Olympic sized pool that we had to handle. I had to understand gardening because we had a lot of grounds to take care of and learn how to wash tennis courts and do all that stuff. And it was an incredible education. It was probably better than going to a graduate school, frankly. And by the you know, before I knew it, I had a new career, and I had employees. I had to do payroll. I had to do insurance. You know, plus Richard and I were, switching off teaching tennis lessons, and then I'd go out on the weekends and play a few pro tournaments in Southern Cal, so that I could stay sharp and be able to be out there ahead of my students. So that's sort of how I ended up in the tennis business. It wasn't something that I really thought I was going to do, but sometimes your passion takes over, and that certainly turned out to be mine. So I'm glad it went the way it did.
Yeah, we are as well. That's really an incredible journey there, Bill. And so definitely have a few questions based on what you just mentioned. And so the first is kind of taking a step back to your first lesson that you ever taught. So once you were told that you were to appear at 8 a.m. the next day to teach your first lesson, I was curious if you can remember how you prepared for that lesson, if at all. And then secondly, what Dick ended up, some of the pointers that he ended up giving you for some novice or even experienced instructors to kind of pick up some tips from.
Sure. I can remember that first lesson pretty vividly because I was petrified. I was scared to death. What in the world do I do for a lesson? As a tennis player, you basically do stuff instinctively, and you don't really think about it. And so now somebody is asking me to go out and start thinking about, how you hit a tennis ball and how you should and so forth. I ended up, giving a volley lesson to a person out there, which, was not a difficult thing to do. And I was a natural server. I could help people, learn how to serve quite easily. So, that first lesson was something that I didn't have any way to prepare for. I just showed up and I got through it and actually developed a lifelong lesson follower from that first experience. But what I did do is I very quickly got brought into Dick Leach's lesson clinics. He had a group of ladies, and he'd call it his large ladies clinic. It wasn't a description of the players. He had 32 ladies. We always laughed about that, but he had an incredible system for running people through paces that were really helpful to develop them as tennis players. And what he would do, he would start off with the basics of, how do you hit a forehand and a backhand and how do you volley and so forth. And he had some, a lot of very straightforward, simple techniques for people to learn to actually become good at tennis fairly quickly. And I'd never thought about the mechanics of it before. And so I picked those up immediately. I was just fascinated by the way he approached things. Once the ladies learned, how to just hit some basic shots, then he started getting into strategy on the courts. And again, I'd always done this stuff instinctively, but I started learning basically the geometry of a tennis court and the angles and, where you should or should not hit the ball. I never even thought about that before as a kid. You just go out there and hit wherever you want. I could see that if I had encountered Dick at a much earlier age, I probably would have been a much better tennis player because I was a kid that just liked to hit the ball as hard as I could. And of course, wear out the backdrop as fast as I could. But I ended up becoming a much, much smarter player as a result of teaching those lessons on the court. And he's got a system. I mean, it'd take a while to explain it to you, but it is scientific. It really works. And if you look at the pros on TV, you can see what they're doing. And it really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I read a few books, one of them that I can remember vividly that helped me as an instructor a lot, and even as a player, was The Inner Game of Tennis by Tim Galloway. Mm-hmm. And that also helped me. So you know, it was an evolution. I was learning as I went, and I was learning by doing, which I think is probably one of the most effective ways to learn.
For sure, Bill. And that is also incredible. And my next question that it popped up in my head about, you know, you just learning on the go. I mean, there's so many different skills that you had to learn that you had never learned in school. I mean, even things like gardening and obviously accounting systems and hiring, I'm sure, and all these. I mean, what are some tips? Because it's actually very interesting that we had Tim Bainton on episode 84, the previous episode, where he's also an expert in developing clubs and improving them and marketing and such. And so it's a great episode, by the way, to check out. But so how did you learn all these different skills? Did you kind of contract out, or did you, you know, what did you do? What's the secret here?
Well, I started off, you know, I graduated from an Ivy League college, and I can remember one of the most embarrassing experiences of my life was on the day that I was supposed to go to the accounting office after getting my degree, and I'm supposed to settle up my student account, and the guy in the office told me that I owed, I don't know, $384.70 or something to before I could leave the campus. And so I sat down to write out a check. And the way I don't think I'd ever written a check for that large an amount before. And I started writing, and I didn't know how to properly write out the amount on the check. Mm-hmm. And the guy just rolled his eyes and told me, he said, you know, no, you gotta do it this way. And that became, you know, something that sort of stuck in my mind. And as a result, I realized I needed a little bit more education. I'd actually taken an accounting class in college, but it was not a very good class, and I didn't learn a whole heck of a lot. So while I was teaching tennis during the day, what I did was I had enrolled in Pasadena City College night classes, and I actually enrolled in an accounting course that took me through the basics. I learned about debits and credits and how to do the accounting cycle and how to read a financial statement and so forth. And I have to say that I think that was one of the most valuable things that I ever did, because later on it enabled me to then start, developing budgets and doing the billing for our club and so forth. So I actually took some initiative outside of just teaching tennis lessons to go out and educate myself a little bit. I did a lot of reading. I had an early working knowledge of computers, because at Dartmouth, one of the things they did was they had the basic, the inventor of the basic computer language was the dean of the college.
Wow.
And they required every course in college to use computers. They give you free access to the Kiewit Computational Center there at Dartmouth College. And so every student in the college going through there actually had a working knowledge of how to program a computer by the time they graduated. And of course, in the engineering classes and stuff, I got fairly adept at doing that. So when I got out, I started using my computer skills to develop a program to track the accounting for the club out at the Westlake Tennis and Swim Club. And it turns out that one of my lessons was a professional computer programmer. So he and I, you know, he told me, he said, well, you should write a program to do this. And so he said, well, I will if you'll help me. So he and I got together and worked again in our off hours to do that. And then we actually developed a little word processor of our own so I could write the monthly club newsletter. And, I'd do that on the computer and send that out. And then, for the gardening, we actually did hire a gardener, but I ended up having to work with him to decide where, you know, how you landscape a steep bank of a hill and what the watering schedules were and how to fix the sprinklers and do all that. And that was really just out in the field. I didn't go to courses for that, but I'd had I'd been exposed to that a little bit growing up because my dad was an engineer and he had taught me how to fix sprinkler heads and do things before I even got there. So I had that and the pool chemistry. you know, that's one of the things that you just get out and you learn by reading the manuals. And I had a person that had to come out and help us with the pool chemistry. But you learn to do that by watching and working with the guy. It's all hands on. So, you know, these are skills. But I think they're, you know, that a little bit of self-education and reading a few books can go a long way.
Wow, Bill. Very impressive stuff. And I mean, just, you know, listening to all the stuff you did and also reading your LinkedIn profile about, it's like, it seems like what is 20 different duties that you took hold of there. I guess I'll read it because it's fun. You know, hired, fired, trained employees, all human resources functions, the pool chemistry, lesson programs, handled mark, wrote and signed checks, did bank reconciliations, owned and operated a tennis shop inside the club. I mean, there's more grounds maintenance. So how did you manage your time during all this, you know, because I mean, there's some people that would take all day doing one of these things. How did you manage your time and do everything?
Well, you know, when you're young and you're not married, you don't have a family, you can sort of dedicate your life to your job. And so, you know, I can basically, when I was working at the Westlake Tennis and Swim Club, it was myself and my friend and my partner, Richard Tripp. And what we would do literally was just divide up the day so that we could each work on various tasks at different times. So, you know, he was also a tennis pro, a teacher. And so yeah, I can remember we would have times where, you know, my lessons, let's say, would start at 8 o'clock in the morning and I would teach till 10 o'clock. And then Richard's lessons would start at 10 o'clock and go to 12. And we sort of had this moment where we would have to do a fast switch. And he'd go from the clubhouse answering the phone and doing some of the books in the background to racing out to the tennis court. And I'd go racing in, just answer the phone and help the customers in the tennis shop and do all that. But, you know, we ended up, you know, working together. It was a 7 day a week, you know, and way more than 12 hours a day because we would, literally, the lessons would start at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then we would work for until 10 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night to finish up the books and count the cash in the shop, and you know, do the whatever the you know the daily cashier's report and all those types of things. So it was really just dedicating yourself to really doing everything. As a young kid, you just don't seem to realize that there's limits to anything. So I worked very hard, and I got pretty good. You know, what I did is I developed systems for handling various things so that it became a routine that was not very difficult to accomplish. And you can do a whole lot of different things if you have a little bit of structure to it. And so I developed a lot of structure, and I also hired a few people that were very good at what they did. And, you know, that when you hire people, you multiply your ability to get stuff done. So I got some assistant tennis pros to help with our lessons in our clinics, just like Dick Leach had done with me. You know, I hired people to work in the tennis shop, a couple of gals that were very good figuring out what styles of ladies' dresses and beds and things and shoes that we should buy. And, you know, so we divvied up the duties. So part of it is developing people under you that can do things well. And that's really the secret to handling a lot of things. You cannot do it all yourself. You have to use other people. So there's a lot of effort going into setting it up. But once you set it up and train people, you can maximize your ability to accomplish things.
Wonderful stuff, Bill. Great advice there as well. And maybe one last question about this. You mentioned systems, and it's extremely important. You know, you hear a lot of people who do extremely well in this world, and they talk about the secret of success is systems. So you did mention, obviously, that you created some financial systems. But in general, what's an example of a system that you're talking about here? I mean, is it an SOP or something like that? Or can you kind of delve into that a little bit?
Well, it's not so much an SOP. I don't think too many people have time to read a manual procedures. It is helpful to write down the sequence in which you do things, so that if you have to hand the job off to another person, it's a to-do list, how you get things done. So basically, the closing procedure at the end of the day for the tennis shop, you needed to do a few things. You know, you sell some shoes, you collect some money, you order some things, you do other things. So at the end of the day, you've got to collect the money, do the sales receipts, and set them up into the accounting records, so that at the end of the month you can produce the reports that you have to do to file your payroll taxes and so forth. So what you have to do is develop a routine, and it helps if you write some of that stuff down. So yes, I would write up little procedures for how you would do the daily cashier's report, and how you would find the numbers from that report to put into your state board of equalization reports to, you know, pay the appropriate sales tax. And then, you know, when you had to do payroll, you know, what are the steps that you go through there to do it? So you know, jotting stuff down and developing routines for doing things is extremely important. And I think that sometimes, particularly in the early years, I was probably more about teaching verbally and doing things. In my current job, it's larger, more complex. And so, yes, we have a standard operating manual, and we've got, you know, our employee reference guide, and we've got all sorts of reviews that we do all the time. But when you're just a two-man operation, working, you know, by yourself to handle all sorts of things, it comes down to the routine that you develop and how you communicate that well to others. So when you talk about systems and procedures with computers, I developed, some notebooks that contained all of the coding for the accounting software and for producing a newsletter, and how you save it and how you store it and, you know, how you call it and all those types of things. So I'm not sure I fully answered your question there, but it was an interesting time to try to get better at everything you did instead of forgetting what you did and having to relearn it.
Yeah, no, you've definitely fully answered my question on that about, just writing down the procedures that you're going through, so that it can be, say, if you were to have to go to a vacation or leave, you know, someone else could pick right back up. So wonderful stuff there. So Bill, obviously you ended up now you're leading the way at La Jolla. So how did your family, and I kind of read up on this before, more for the audience, how did your family end up convincing you to lead the way at La Jolla?
Well, my younger brother, Bob, he actually came to work for my dad here at the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club right out of college. And he probably started working down here in about 1972 or thereabouts. And he was pretty frustrated with the way things were working, because people have been doing things the same way for many, many years, and he saw new ways to do stuff, and nobody wanted to change. So he was looking for how can I, you know, bring somebody in that would make a difference. Simultaneously, I ended up getting married and having my first child while I was out at Westlake, and I can remember distinctly. I'd wake up after my first daughter was born, Tiffany, I'd wake up at, to go teach my tennis lessons at 7 o'clock in the morning before she woke up. And then I'd work all day and have to handle the men's clinics in the evenings up until about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And of course, by the time I got home, you know, she'd gone to bed. And it got to a point where, my baby would look at me and start screaming because she didn't know who I was. And, so my wife and I talked about it a lot, and it turns out that Dick Leach at that time was getting, ready to, sell the tennis club. And it also turned out that the general manager at the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club, a guy named Bill Bond Sr., had retired in the summer of 1979. So, my brother, actually gave me a call. in July of that year, and he said, you know, he says, you should think about coming to work for the family business, which I had deliberately avoided. I did not think I was ever going to work for the family. I wanted to make my own way and do things my way and so forth. But when I started thinking about the family pressures and working 7 days a week, you know, my brother came to me and said, you know, if you came to work at the beach club, you could work hours that were like 9 to 5 and only 6 days a week. And I said, we've got some staff that can do things. And I said, are you kidding me? That sounded like a dream job. And so, you know, I talked to my wife about it when I realized they were about to sell the tennis club. And I didn't know that was happening at the time. So I was a little bothered by that and realizing that my fate was not in my own hands. And I'm working this hard and not developing any equity in the business. So that was sort of an eye opener. I sort of thought about that and said, you know, this could disappear in a moment. You know, sell it to somebody else. And that new owner may want to come in and do what I'm doing, and I'm out. So when my brother came and talked to me, I said, I'm going to suck it up. And I called my dad and talked to him. And he said, yeah, he thinks he has a place for me. And he said, come on down. And if you make the move, he says, he'll, you know, integrate me into the business and we'll take it one step at a time. So I can remember packing up the car with the kids and the dogs and everything. And we drove to La Jolla and found our new home. And I have a cartoon on the wall of my office that shows a janitor taking the sign off a broom closet and putting up a title for the next VP, which was supposedly me coming in. And that's pretty much the way it worked. And my dad had one thing he wanted me to do every day. And that was he wanted me to start out the day by meeting with him at 9 o'clock every morning. And here I'd been running a club and in charge of everything. And now I'm working for him. So it was a little bit of a change for me. But I came in and started learning how the business worked. And then he gave me various things that I needed to do on a daily basis. But really what we would do is we'd pick areas of the club that needed to be improved. And as a pretty good example, we had a switchboard at the front desk that had the plug and pull cords. You may remember those in the days of Lily Tomlin, where you have the headset on and you talk to the person as you're connecting the extension. You know, we needed to modernize that, and so one of my projects was to replace the switchboard in the telephone system at the club. And so, you know, in doing that, we had to go to a digital system and had to renumber all the rooms because you couldn't exactly dial apartment H on a telephone. You had to get an extension. So I became very familiar with those systems, and I had to take our accounts payable. We actually had a computer to run our, I should go start off with the payroll, and that had one of those computers where you drop the cardboard slips into the bin, and it would, you know, thumb through. Didn't have a monitor. It would just produce the paychecks using these pre-printed cards. And so we needed to evolve on that. And computers were just coming out. So my computer background working out at Westlake and all of that put me in a spot where I could go into the accounting department and actually introduce computers. And we actually got a full-size accounts payable system that I instituted.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I redid the payroll system. I ended up having to develop a computer process for the purchasing department. Then we had a lot of projects. We had to renovate a lot of our rooms, so I had to work with contractors to, you know, rebuild every room on the property, starting at the south end and going to the north and back again. And what I ended up doing by making that move is I got to be very familiar with every aspect of the property. It was, didn't matter whether it was a housekeeping department or the engineering department or the accounting department, you know, or the insurance policies. Or, you know, I ended up dealing at one time or another with all of those. So by the time of it, 10 years later, my dad passed away. And it turns out that my brother and I were the two most knowledgeable people in the company and in the family to run the property. And so the rest of the family members voted us in to take over the leadership position at the club. And I was the older brother, and my brother agreed to be the vice president, and I became the president. And so, but we worked together as a team to try to solve the issues that faced us in those days. And we went through a very big change in our family to move from a family trust type of business to a family partnership. So a lot of changes that we went through. And really what had happened is that I had developed enough on-the-ground expertise at every level of the company to understand how it all fit together and how it worked. So it turned out that I was the natural person to step in and keep things running. I didn't even mention the tennis tournaments. I mean, I started off running national tennis tournaments in December of 1979. I took over where Bill Bond had left off and ended up running the national father sons and the national 45s. And anyway, I learned how to run and execute a full-fledged national championship. And, you know, I actually computerized that process as well. So anyway, a lot of stuff along the way that gave me a terrific background for doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, a lot of impressive stuff indeed. And I'm also very impressed that you and your brother, you know, just you exposed yourself to all the facets, you know, so that you knew what was going on. And I think, you know, when somebody does that, as opposed to just isolating themselves they'll have a more successful business. And so basically, from what how you answered my previous question, I feel like I kind of know the answer to this question. But I want to ask you, you know, in the world of, especially, you know, where I'm from on the East Coast, I've seen a lot of clubs close down. And yet La Jolla, my research is correct, has been running for over 90 years. So I'm just wondering what the key or some keys are to having a very successful and long living tennis club.
First of all, we have a terrific location. You can't take that away from us. But the reason we're here and a lot of clubs aren't is because I think we've reinvented ourselves in many ways. My dad started this club started, my great grandfather purchased it in 1935. So by the time I got here in 1979, basically a half a century had elapsed. And you can imagine, you know, you take anything and let it be exposed to heavy use for 50 years, it's going to start falling apart, right? Well, my dad actually was pretty smart about how he did things. And he actually started a program of reinvesting in the property. He started actually plowing $1 million a year from the proceeds of the business back into redeveloping the property. So remember, I talked about dealing with construction companies. Well, that it was a direct result of that decision on his part that we renovated every single room on the property, all of our common areas, the swimming pool, the tennis courts, the golf courts. I mean, we did everything on the property over a period of, you know, 30 years or 20 years that I can think of. And so that was one thing. So we kept the property fresh without changing its feel. And then the other thing that the family has done that I think has been very, very smart is we actually had checked the demographics of the club in about 1992. And we found that the average age of the club was about 65 years old for a member. And that was, and it was going up. It was getting worse. So you were talking about some clubs that went to extinction. And what, you know, the tendency is, you know, when you've got the dues-paying member, he's going to say, hey, I want to use the tennis court, kick that kid off the court because he's not paying the bill. I am. And, you know, so you sort of put the juniors in a second-class spot, and you start to, you know, targeting everything for the older part of your membership. And, you know, that works for a while, but the trouble is they start getting older and they start dying off, and your club starts becoming less relevant. So we as a family, we made a conscious effort to try to rejuvenate the club. One of the things that we did is we started offering time payment plans for juniors, for kids of current members, so that when they got to the age of 25, that they could actually afford to buy their own membership. And then we started adding programs and changed our policies, changed the way our lesson programs work. So we started offering, you know, active clinic programs, and, you know, we have a kids camp in the summer, and we've done a whole bunch of things that have made it a lot more interesting to young families to be members of our club, as opposed to just people that are octogenarians. And the result was that our average age today is now about 42. So, you know, that's a gigantic change from when you're looking. And we've got about 1,400 memberships in the club. So when you look at that's a big change. And I think it has helped us keep the club relevant over those years. And what you'll see when you come down here is you'll see families having fun. You'll see kids. You know, we are about kids and families. We're not just about the senior members of the club. And I think that the kids are the future of the club. Is, you know, if you're not bringing them back into the fold when they get to the age where they can afford a club membership, then you're going to lose out over time. So I think keeping the property in good repair, changing with the times a little bit, we relaxed our dress code rules so that, you know, I don't have to wear a coat and tie to go into our restaurants. You know, we've kept it current. You know, we do have internet here now. And,
excellent.
You know, exactly. So the club has evolved, and it's also refocused on making it a younger experience for people. So I think it's fun for the older folks too. I think in the end they actually enjoyed that, but a lot of clubs fall into the trap of not rejuvenating. And I think that's a major focus that you need to have if you want to be around for the long haul.
Yeah, definitely. Bill, if you're out there and you're a club owner or a coach, I highly encourage you to hit the 30-second rewind button maybe five or six times and listen in on that again. Some great tips, Bill. We appreciate that. And so, you know, as I alluded to in your intro, you have had many positions really contributing a lot to the tennis world. And one of these positions was being a USTA section president, as well as a co-chair of USTA's Davis Cup and Fed Cup committee. So I wanted to ask you what that experience was like for you, especially with regards to the Davis and Fed Cup duties.
Well, I am very indebted to Franklin Johnson, who's a former USTA president from Southern California, who, when he became president, appointed me to the Davis Cup committee. And actually, I became a chair of the Davis Cup committee and later also of the Davis Cup and Fed Cup committees. And that afforded me an amazing opportunity to do things that would support our Davis Cup teams. So as an example, I've been able to travel all over the world to ties. I've been to Croatia, and I've been to Germany, and I've been all over the place helping to, you know, put these ties on behalf of the U.S. And then at home, I ended up actually hosting a couple of ties. One of them we hosted right here at the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club. So, I got to learn the inside and out, you know, what it takes to put on an event like that. You know, we had to build a stadium court and had to market the tickets and, you know, figure out the travel packages and do all the stuff that and do the fundraising to make it all happen. So it's really been an incredible experience. You know, it's fun to meet the team members and so forth, but really the job of being in that position is to engage the community in Davis Cup ties. So we would reach out to create kids clinics and to have events that would give the media a reason to focus on bringing the tie to your city. And, you know, so it added another dimension to experiences that you know, really contribute to just promoting tennis in general. And, you know, I found that very, very interesting. And when I was up at, when I was the president of the Southern California Tennis Association, also had the opportunity to get into the inner workings of a professional tennis tournament, because we had the men's professional tournament up in Los Angeles that they held at UCLA, had a lot of different names. It started off as the Pacific Southwest and went through a lot of iterations. I think it was the Farmers Classic before in its later days, but I got to see how a professional tournament works and meet all the people that make it happen. And it's a lot like starting out at a tennis club, and you just get out in the field and you start doing stuff and you learn how things work. And so it's added a lot to my my background. And and of course, I've met tons and tons of people around the world right now that make it so that no matter where I travel, I've got friends everywhere I go. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome stuff, Bill, once again. And so you mentioned the, you know, the great efforts that you undertook to promote the tie through other events, such as kid events and such, and just general marketing. So in your opinion, I mean, and, you know, I haven't been around Davis and Fed Cup ties. I don't really know what's going on these days, but do they still do these sorts of things? And I mean, is there any difference from then and now besides the technologies? And are, you know, do you think they're doing a good enough job of the promotion of Davis Cup?
Well, I think, first of all, you're asking at a time when they have just decided to change the format of Davis Cup.
Which they have again.
So it's a very different animal this year than it was last year and for the last 50 years before it. The you know, this year they're going to have basically the World Cup of Nations for tennis in November, where they bring all the nations to one spot. And you know, they have one great big playoff for a week. So it's a little different than it has been. Up until then, you know, they would have the home and away format with one country playing another country. So two nations going to where either the home site of one nation or the home site of the other nation. So when we held ties while I was involved in it, it all focused on trying to activate the community in which the tie was held. And it was very nationalistic, because you would come in and it would be the U.S. against another country. And so, you know, when you that creates a lot of interest and actually a lot of media promotion. You know, we would have, for instance, when it was in La Jolla, you know, I got the Youth Tennis San Diego, which is the junior arm of the district at that time, to bring kids in to do the flag procession on the court. And they would supply the ball kids on the courts, and they would hold a clinic where they would get the Davis Cup team out on the court, you know, with, you know, 600 to 800 kids coming in from the surrounding areas to participate in a tennis festival that was all themed around the Davis Cup match that was happening that weekend. And so there's a lot of stuff that would happen. It creates a way to involve the community in professional tennis that a lot of times tournaments don't really achieve. So, you know, I don't know. You know, that format still sort of exists for players that aren't at the in the world group. I shouldn't say sort of; it does exist. That original format exists. The United States team at this point is actually automatically into that world group playoff, so we won't have any ties for Davis Cup this year. in the United States up because they're going to go to the World Group. So that opportunity will disappear. But on the other hand, it's been working very well for a lot of years. And I know throughout the world, it's one of the ways that that you bring professional tennis to underdeveloped countries. And if they have a Davis Cup tie in their part of the world, it's probably the first time that that the people in there in those areas have ever gotten to see up close some of the great players in the world. So it's an amazing opportunity to promote tennis, but it is definitely changing. So the jury's out on how it's working today versus versus the past few years. But there's a lot that goes into it.
For sure, Bill. Great stuff. And so, I mean, obviously I have to ask you this question, I guess. So what were your thoughts when you heard about the change? I mean, is this something that you think will work out? I mean, you know, the jury's out, but I mean, what did you think? Did you think we should have stuck with what we had, or is, you know, you think the change will be successful?
I absolutely think a change had to happen. I don't think there was any choice in the matter. When you look at it, what I found is that increasingly it became more and more difficult to attract the best players to play on a nation's team. That we were pretty lucky because we had at the United States because we had the Bryan brothers and then we had Andy Roddick and James Blake that were all top players that really had committed themselves to playing in the Davis Cup. But we also had some pretty notable absences in Davis Cup over the years. You know, if you look at Pete Sampras or Andre Agassi, and you know, there's a whole bunch of really amazing players that really stopped participating in Davis Cup. And I'm not just talking about the United States; I'm talking about around the world. So the relevance of it was starting to become questionable. And the thing that just didn't make sense is that for players on the pro tour to participate in Davis Cup, they had to be able to set aside four periods of 10 days each to participate in Davis Cup. So you start thinking about it. That's 40 days out of the year with an active tournament calendar around it. And then they didn't earn any ATP points for playing in those Davis Cup matches. And there was, at least the United States paid a little bit of appearance money for the players that participated on the team, but it was sort of token compensation versus what they would earn in tournaments or exhibitions. So for a player to represent his country, he had to agree to basically take a putt, cut and pay, take a major amount of time out of his schedule to participate on the team, and he earned no points for doing that. So what we were seeing worldwide is the slow, I think, ultimate extinction of Davis Cup, while you ended up with the Pro Tour coming in with you know, with competing team formats. So you have the Laver Cup and you have the Hopman Cup and others that were offering players prize money and, you know, a much shorter time frame. I really think the days of Davis Cup were pretty numbered. So, you know, when you look at the new format, you have given the top players now a reason to get back on the court and represent their country, because they will get ATP points. They will get prize money. They don't have to commit as much of their schedule to doing it. And frankly, I think when you bring a bunch of nations together, as in a World Cup soccer event, I think it's going to be an amazing event. And you've got an incredible sponsor that's come in to help make it all work. So my answer is I actually think it's important that the ITF changed that format. They had to change it. I don't know if this is the exact correct formula for it, but I think it's got a lot of positives, and I really think people need to give it a try, because without that, I think in a few years, we wouldn't even have a Davis Cup competition. It would disappear.
Those are all great points, Bill, for people to consider. I know there's obviously a lot of fans who I'd wish it had stayed the same, but you know, you definitely have to look at all sides of the coin, including from the player's view as well. So appreciate that. And as far as Davis Cup, I'm just curious about your maybe specific experience. You know, was there one particular tie in some country that you that is most memorable for you? And if so, why?
The ties that were most memorable for me, I mean, I had a couple of them. I had one crushing experience in Russia where we ended up with a tie score going into the last rubber, the last match, and had Andy Roddick playing on clay at the end of the weekend, and he played a match that lasted for about 5 hours. He ended up serving for the match, I believe, 3 times in the fifth set where he'd broken the other player and stepped up to the line to hold serve. How many times does Andy Roddick lose serve? In the big picture, not very often. Well, he lost his serve enough and ended up losing, it was something like 17-15 in the fifth set. So it was an incredibly dramatic tie, and it was, you know, really, really great tennis. But it was heartbreaking. But then the following year, the United States made it back to the finals, and so did Russia. And because this time, instead of it being in Russia, we're in Portland, Oregon, we ended up having, you know, the home crowd advantage. And we had another very dramatic tie, and I think it came down to the final match. And the U.S. ended up winning it. I think Andy Roddick ended up winning that match. And, you know, so we had the joy of actually bringing the Davis Cup home while I was chair of that committee. And so that put me sort of right in the middle of all the stuff that was happening. And, you know, that was certainly an incredibly memorable moment. But I had two other memorable moments, and really they are the tie that we put on here in La Jolla. I have never really experienced the power of the Davis Cup competition until that moment when we actually built a tennis court out on our golf course. We had 5,000 people coming out to watch it, and it was a incredibly special event. Had the blimp flying overhead, had the stealth bomber come over and do an appearance, and you know, we had some just amazing moments. We also had a very unusual situation as the United States was playing Romania in that match, and the second day of Davis Cup under the old format is always a doubles match, right? It's one match. And it turns out that one of the Romanian players, right at the end of the first set, pulled a muscle in his rib cage that made it so that they had to default the match. Now, this is after about 1 hour of play, and you've got the stands filled with people that came to watch an afternoon of tennis. And they were very, very, I mean, potentially a disaster here for us. But we had an interesting situation because we had Patrick McEnroe was the coach of the team. And you had John McEnroe, who was actually working in the commentary booth. He was in the TV booth up at the top of the stands. And then you had the Bryan twins playing doubles, of course, right? So somebody had the amazing idea to have a demonstration event where we ended up pitting the Bryan brothers against the McEnroe brothers. And I can remember when they made that decision, they did it to the theme of Rocky's music, where, you know, Rocky climbing up the steps. And John McEnroe comes to the front of the booth and rips off his jacket like Superman. and then we got an amazing exhibition. So I have people today that come back that were attending that match And the only thing they can remember about the Davis Cup match was, do you remember when the McEnroe brothers played the Bryan brothers? And how often is that going to happen? But it was one of those moments that was just truly magical. And then I had one other, and that was when we ended up building a clay court in left field down in Petco Park to host the tie against Great Britain. And just an incredible venue, an incredible spot. And it was really another very, very special moment. So that's more than you asked me. But
wow, yeah. No, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Especially the one about the brothers against the brothers. That was cool. You turned a negative, I guess, into a big positive, and kudos to whoever thought about that. Brilliant, brilliant. And Bill, so obviously our whole aim is to improve and grow the game of tennis. I'm actually vice president of the Montgomery County Tennis Association, and we're trying to do that in our county. And then obviously, we're all trying to do that. So what do you think that the USTA and other organizations need to do to improve the state of tennis in the United States and grow the game?
Well, my experience with programs that have been successful, it comes down to the people in the local area. And so I really think the USGA needs to really focus on supporting the local superheroes that are out there in the field making stuff happen. So you think about the impact that a Robert Lansdorp had on the Orange County community. In our area, we had a guy named Bill Folsom, or I should say Wilbur Folsom, who developed countless top players in the world. Had Teach Tennant, who developed Maureen Connolly. You had you had Vic Braden. You had just people that come out and they are like the Pied Pipers, and to me, it's all about getting the kids into the game at a young age. They have so many opportunities right now to play in sports. And I frankly don't think that tennis is capturing as much of the younger population as it needs to. And so when you start talking about trying to capture the young people, that comes back to the idea of family. So I think you've got to get families out on the tennis court together. You've got to create events that bring the mother and the father and the kid all having fun together on the court. And I think that will help build tennis. I don't think it's about, they've got the new emphasis on red, orange, and green balls and the lower bouncing tennis balls and shorter rackets and shorter courts. Those are all helpful tools, but it all comes down to the people. And if you can get a few parents to decide that they want to do what they did for soccer a few years ago or Little League baseball, years before that, it comes down to getting those parents, instead of bringing the kids out to those other places, get them to bring them out to the tennis court. It truly is a sport that does a lot of good for you. It trains you in all sorts of ways. And, it's a sport for a lifetime. Pretty tough to get a football team together these days, at my age. But I can get a tennis and a doubles match together in split second and have a great time doing it. So.
For sure, Bill. Sport of a lifetime. I mean, like you said, I've seen people playing competitively even into their 90s and probably beyond. So it's incredible.
Absolutely.
And so, Bill, I obviously appreciate your time so much. I know we've been speaking for a while today and have enjoyed every minute. But just a couple more questions, if you don't mind. And this one is a fun one. So if you could have a huge billboard and write anything that you'd want on it for everybody to see in a highly trafficked place, what would that billboard say?
And what's the topic?
It could really be anything. I mean, in my mind, something inspiring, but it really could be any message that you have in your mind or that you some sort of belief that you have.
Well, I think it would be get involved. You know, make something your life. Do something. Find a passion and live it. Get out there and make it happen. I love the Nike slogan of just do it. Don't sit around on your duff. Get out and make your life an active life.
Love it. Very inspiring. Appreciate that, Bill. It's awesome. And where can we go to learn more about you and La Jolla, you know, whether that's website, social media, or anything else?
Well, the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club has a nice website. It's called ljbtc.com. That's the initials of La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club. And, you know, that's great. I don't have a website for myself. I actually have a Facebook account, but I don't have time to be posting on it.
So, no, you're not selfing every day?
I'm not,
you know, posting,
I'm not
selfies?
Selfing. No. I leave that to my daughters. And, but,
there you go.
But no, I think, you know, it's I don't have any great spot to, but the Beach Club has a terrific history. I think it's worth the, you know, people getting on there and seeing what we're doing. You know, we've got, we do have some great, the Beach Club itself has got some wonderful Facebook pages and Twitter accounts and the like, so you can do that. But I don't have any really novel ideas for that, but there is information out there on the internet, so.
Great, Bill. Yeah, and I don't blame you with everything you're doing. It's definitely better if you're not on social media than if you are, unless you really need to be. So that's great. And we'll obviously link or post all the links on the show notes page for this episode. So you can definitely go check out La Jolla's website on the show notes page. And before I let you go, Bill, again, really appreciate your time. What is one key tip that you can give our audience to help them improve their tennis games?
There's probably two that I can give you. One of them is use the backboard. It's the most humbling teacher there is, and you can learn at your own pace. And the second thing is get out and play tournament tennis, because it forces you to really, it makes your practice sessions more meaningful. You will get out and you will improve at a much quicker rate if you have a goal, and the goal would be playing in a tournament. And you will also learn from your opponents what it is that you're doing wrong. So those are probably my two things.
Love that, Bill. I still haven't been able to defeat the backboard after all these years. And also with with tournament tennis, I mean, you're totally right, of course. I mean, as soon as I register for a tournament, I'm instantly eating much better than I used to, and really focused in training and all these things. And, you know, it's no better motivator than when you lose to a higher quality opponent and your game is exposed, and then you have a lot of things to work on. So great stuff there, Bill. And so again, Bill, I really do appreciate your time and all your contributions to the tennis world. And it really was a pleasure and an honor to speak with you today, and really enjoyed it. And I'm sure the audience did as well, and will learn a lot from this episode. So thanks a lot for being a guest on the Tennis Files podcast, and I really appreciate it, Bill.
Thanks for inviting me to participate. And don't forget to get out on the tennis court once in a while.
Oh, I definitely will. I'm planning on it soon. So thanks again, Bill. All the best, and hope to talk with you again soon.
Super. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right. I really hope you enjoyed this episode with Bill Kellogg. Bill, a huge shout out to you, and thanks so much for taking the time to be a guest on the podcast. Really enjoyed speaking with you and learning about all your fantastic ideas and viewpoints and experiences along the way. Very, very cool, and I really admire what you've done in the tennis world. And I would really appreciate it if you all would subscribe to the Tennis Files podcast, and you can do that by hitting the subscribe button on the podcast app of your choice. For iTunes, you can go to tennisfiles.com/iTunes and hit the subscribe button there. But in any case, I'd really appreciate that subscribe. As always, you can check out all the show notes on the show notes page. You can find links to anything that we talked about today, and obviously some text and explanation of what to expect in the episode and so forth. And you can do that by going to tennisfiles.com/85. And last but definitely not least, I'd like to leave you all with a quote for today. And this quote is by James Cameron. And James said, "If you set your goals ridiculously high and it's a failure, you will fail above everyone else's success." Very powerful quote there. Well, thanks again, as always, for tuning in to the podcast. I really do appreciate all your support and kind messages and I know you all email me and send me Facebook messages and so forth and comment and like. I really appreciate every single one of those. So thank you so much for that. And I'll continue to put out weekly episodes and work on Tennis Summit 2019 coming up in a couple months. And I'll keep you updated with all that. And if you'd like to get all these updates, you can subscribe to my newsletter at tennisfiles.com and you'll see an opt-in for that. So I really do appreciate it, and get out there and play some tennis, come home and figure out what you did well and not well, and pick out something to work on and improve the next time around. So, really appreciate you listening and for all your support, as I mentioned, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files Podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files Podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.